This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 118 was recorded on May 17th, 2018. I'm Eric Townsend. Regular listeners already know how much I'm looking forward to this week's feature interview with JDI Research founder Juliet DeClercq. Juliet sees the current rally in the U.S. dollar as a counter-trend move and an opportunity to enter new short positions with better location, which, needless to say, is at odds with the bullish views that many of our other guests have expressed on this program. Juliet is probably best known for her incredibly detailed graphs and charts, which are normally available only to her paying institutional advisory clients. But she's treated Macro Voices listeners to a fantastic chart deck that you're not going to want to miss. You'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email, or click the red download button on our homepage at macrovoices.com. Be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when Tony Greer, market analyst with TG Macro, will be joining us to discuss the breakout in the 10-year Treasury, gold, crude oil, and of course, the U.S. dollar.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, that S&P 500 is now just taking a bit of a pause from that big rally we had the other week. We're trading around this 2717 at the time of recording. What's your thinking here on the stock markets?
Well, you know, the rally really looked solid through Monday. Now, the fact that we've had a pullback is no surprise at all. We had this very much, very widely anticipated event of the 10-year Treasury breaking that key support level at 3.05 early Tuesday morning to the point where 24 hours later we were past 3.10. So, you know, frankly, if you had asked me 2 weeks ago, hey, imagine that we're at 3.10 on the U.S. 10-year, what do you think stocks are doing? I would have said way down. And the fact that we got a fairly modest pullback that only lasted a day or so, and we're maybe struggling to limp higher, but still edging a little bit higher here, I would have feared, Patrick, that breakout to the upside on Treasury yields could have spelled a much deeper downside correction for the stock market than we've seen so far. Now, with respect to the big picture, the scenario that we've talked about in the past of maybe we're headed back towards new all-time highs, upwards of 3,000 on the S&P for a top, you know, I'm not really feeling that anymore. And the reason is we're just not seeing the volume and momentum that I would expect if that was the game. So very much in line with the comments you made last week, Patrick, I think what we're probably looking at here is, yeah, summer rally, but we'll be lucky if we can get to a retest of the prior highs. I wouldn't be surprised if we get a failed rally that breaks down below that. Again, what I've said in the past is all bets are off if we see a breakout beyond 3.05 on the 10-year Treasury. We've got that now. So I think that what comes next for the stock market is very much in question. And as I say, I'm surprised that we haven't seen more downside reaction in equities in response to that breakout on the Treasury yield. So I still think there's a summer rally that seems to be in play, but I'm not nearly as optimistic as I was that we might get to new all-time highs.
All right, well, let's move on to that U.S. dollar index, because one of the characteristics, at least that I find very bullish always, is that whenever there's a throwback, it never is really deep, doesn't last very long, and the buyers are rushing right back in to take it higher. And that certainly fits the bill for what we just saw in the dollar index, which is kind of pulled back from the 93.5 level, dropped about a point to 92.5 into the start of the week, and suddenly we're off to the races again with the dollar. Is this another surge higher in the dollar index for you?
Well, you know, there's about a dozen people on Twitter today saying, okay, that's it. This is the top on the dollar index. It's all over. It's headed down from here. The thing is, those are the same people that have tweeted the same thing about five times now, as soon as we had a pause that lasted for a few hours on this relentless move higher that we've seen and since that breakout a few weeks ago. So, you know, I want to save most of the dollar discussion for Juliet DeClercq, because that's going to be the primary topic of our interview. But I would say from my my perspective, what I see on the chart looks pretty bullish. Seems to me like we have a bullish breakout here. Juliet has a very different view, and I think you're going to be very interested to see the evidence that she puts forth with the series of graphs and charts she's going to present to make her case for why she feels we're headed back to the downside after this rally plays out.
Well, let's move on to crude oil. How did this week's inventory numbers look?
Well, Patrick, we had a bullish surprise this week. It started with a bearish expectation from API. They thought there was going to be a big build on crude oil inventories. When the EIA report came out, it was actually a drawdown of 1.4 million barrels nationally. Cushing, Oklahoma, building, but only a de minimis 53,000 barrels. Gasoline, really big, 3.8 million barrel drawdown. And distillates also drawing down 92,000. Barrels. So with these drawdowns across the board, with the exception of a very small build at Cushing, you know, that's a bullish surprise, no surprise at all that it shocked the market almost 50 cents higher in a matter of seconds. The thing that actually surprised me, Patrick, considering it was a bullish surprise, and what we've seen in the last few weeks is the market is looking for any excuse it can find to rally. In fact, we've shrugged off really, really bearish inventory reports and rallied anyway in the last few weeks. Well, when we had this, there was an immediate reaction, but then it kind of got faded and it took it a day or two before it started to catch up. We did see higher for the rest of the day yesterday and into today, but now we're correcting back down this afternoon. Of course, it's options expiration on crude oil futures. All kinds of monkey business can go on OPEX day, so we have to kind of disqualify the closing number because it may have been a result of expiring options that pinned the closing print there. In any event, it's not as much upside action as I would expect based on the number, and that tells me that maybe this rally is finally starting to run out of steam.
You know, Eric, I thought it was incredibly interesting that WTI is trailing a little bit to Brent, which is accelerating. The spread between the two seems to be widening. What's your general view on the direction of oil at this point, and what do you make of the widening of that spread between the two?
Well, I'm trying to figure out that widening, and this is something that's been persistent for the last couple of weeks. One of the services that I follow looks at all of the different energy contracts, whether it be RBOB gasoline or gas oil or heating oil or whatever, and they've been pointing out that WTI has been the laggard in the pack for the last couple of weeks. I'm really not clear on what's causing that, but you're right. Brent has been stronger, moving over $80, psychological number, very important. So it seems like the strength is more there in the Brent market, and that is widening the spread. I don't have an explanation for why that's occurring other than to agree with you that yes, it is occurring. As far as my outlook, I've been feeling until this inventory probably still higher. There's been a relentless uptrend for the last few weeks, and I think it's primarily being driven by geopolitical tension and fears of what could escalate in the Middle East, and it feels to me like it still has farther to go. Now, the one caveat to that, as I said, is we had a fairly bullish inventory surprise that I thought would have sparked a rally. Happened a day before options expiration, so maybe that's the reason nothing really came of it. I'm not sure. We'll see what happens tomorrow on Friday. But in any case, I think we've got higher to go. The thing is, this market's been going straight up for quite a while, and it's been ignoring some fairly significant bearish news. Once again this week, we had another 20,000 barrels per day of U.S. production increase. That annualizes to 1 million barrels a year, not quite as much as we've had for the last few weeks. Exports are through the roof, 2.5 million barrels per day. A lot of people are actually questioning whether that number could even be real, because unless there's a bunch of more VLCC exports that we don't even know about, it's hard to imagine how that much oil could have been exported in the last week. But, you know, that works out to about 18 million barrels on the week exported. So needless to say, if exports were still illegal, there would have been a huge build on inventory this week. The thing is that the geopolitical risk, I think, is probably at this point mostly priced in. We don't know if there's going to be an escalation to an outright war, but if there isn't, and particularly if things de-escalate, the market's been ignoring a fair amount of bearish news for quite a while here. And we really do have prices at a level that is dramatically increasing shale production. We see the U.S. production numbers through the roof. We see the rig count increasing. Art Berman had a piece out this week saying that the Bakken now has a record number of operating rigs. Even at the height of the shale boom the first time around, they never had as many operating rigs as they have right now in the Bakken. So there's a lot of reasons for oil to have a significant downside correction. I thought it had a ways further to go because I feel like the geopolitical fear is not quite out of the system yet. When it does come out of the system, I think there's a correction coming, but probably we're not quite there yet.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because gold can't seem to catch a bid. You know, we were looking at that 1300 to 1310 kind of area where a lot of the lows have come and highs have come in the past, but we really broke that on the downside with a breakdown toward 1290 here. Do you think there's more downside for gold here?
I'm actually surprised that we've only seen as much downside as we have. I'm pretty confident, at least I'm persuaded, that it was the breakout beyond that red line in the sand at 3.05 on the Treasury yield. I think that was the straw that broke the camel's back and led to giving up that support level around 1305 to 1308. You know, as far as I was concerned, once that broke, the door was open to the repair areas that show up on the TPO charts down in the low 1200s between 1210 and 1225. Or so. The fact that we're still up here at $12.89, only, you know, $15 lower than before the Treasury yield broke, is kind of surprising to me. And of course, the logic there is most people consider Treasuries to be a risk-free asset. I personally wouldn't agree with that, but they're seen as the competitor to gold. The more that Treasuries yield, as gold continues to yield zero, the more people prefer Treasuries. So increasing Treasury yield, bearish for gold. You know, it seems to me that if so many people thought if it breaks 305, it's going to keep going, we're going to see much higher Treasury rates, to the extent that you believe that forecast, it's got to be fairly bearish for gold. And we've only been down 15 bucks, so I'm surprised we haven't moved further to the downside.
All right, well, let's move on to the 10-year Treasury yields, because first of all, we've always been talking about that 3% round number, and then when Julian Brigden was on the show, he was talking 305 on the 10-year, but here we are, and we're trading at 311 on the yield. What's going on here? Is this now the melt-up in yields and the breakdown in bonds happening real-time?
I think it is, Patrick. And, you know, Julian Brigden gave us that number 3.05. Citibank had a research note out confirming that. Several technicians that I've seen in various places have confirmed that number of somewhere between 3.04 and 3.05. So we've definitely broken out past that. You know, I was thinking that, boy, you know, so many people in the market think this is coming. The market loves to prove people wrong. You know, what a setup it could be for a short squeeze, a head fake in the other direction. I thought we were going to get there, but I thought maybe there would be a head fake the other way first. And it turns out, it seems like not. And I think one of the things that, in hindsight, I probably should have analyzed differently, I was looking at the massive, massive short positioning in the commitment of traders reports. The thing is, when you see that in a commodity like oil, where all the trading occurs in the futures, it's really, really important to, you know, to take heed when you see everybody on one side of the boat. The thing is, the actual treasury market is so much bigger than the treasury futures market that what's happening in the underlying treasuries is really what's governing the show. So even that lopsided positioning on treasury futures, it didn't get in the way. There was no short squeeze. We've pushed through it. And I think it's testament to the strength of this rally in yield, breakdown in prices. I think it probably has a lot farther to go. So the big question in my mind is, okay, at what levels on the 10-year yield do things start to break? We've had a lot of guests on the program that say they think this whole weakness in equity and the breakdown in the vol complex was triggered by higher treasury yields. Well, now we've got the signal. We're past the everybody's favorite red line in the sand that we're going to much higher treasury yields. Okay, what's going to break and when's it going to break? That's really what's on my mind. So that's what I'll be looking to discuss with all of our guests in coming weeks. Now, this breakout beyond 3.05 actually happened while we were taping the interview with Juliet DeClercq. So she's not going to have any comment on the breakout itself because we didn't know about it until we had finished the interview. I do want to get into it with Tony Greer in our postgame segment, though, because I know he's got some views as to where this thing may be headed.
All right. Well, thanks for the summary, Eric. Now, JDI research founder Juliet DeClercq is this week's featured interview guest. Eric's interview with Juliet is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
this week's special guest. Here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is JDI Research founder Juliet DeClercq. Juliet prepared a fantastic chart book that you're not going to want to miss, so I strongly encourage you to download it now, as we'll be referring to it throughout the interview. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you're not yet registered, just go to macrovoices.com and look for the red button labeled Looking for the Downloads above Juliet's picture. Juliet, thanks so much for coming back and joining us again on Macro Voices.
Well, Eric and Patrick, thank you very much for having me on such a high-caliber podcast. Now, Eric, I know that all you want to know is where the dollar is going. And I'm afraid 2017 was rather straightforward, and 2019 may be straightforward as well. But 2018 is a transition year and a time to be more tactical. I've not found the magic recipe yet this year, so this interview will focus on my thought process for you to extrapolate your own tactical game plan. I've put together a chart pack of exclusive macro pictures, some from my CIO-tailored reports and some created just for you guys. Please make sure you download it because I will refer it through the whole interview. And also, you know that my motto at JDI is better a good chart than a 10-page waffle.
Well, I have really been looking forward to this interview. I've learned from past experience to be very careful about fading your views on the U.S. dollar because your track record is so impeccable. But honestly, Juliet, I'm at a loss to understand why you're still so bearish on the dollar. We've had so many good arguments from other guests saying, look, Treasury yields are headed up. And just on Tuesday morning, as we're speaking, we're looking at the 10-year Treasury in the United States, flirting with that 3.05 key resistance level that everybody's been watching. And other guests that we've had in the program have been saying, look at the differentials versus the German Bund. It's only getting better, and that's got to help the U.S. dollar. Meanwhile, we've seen a breakout in the U.S. dollar index over the last couple of weeks out of a consolidation pattern that had lasted for a couple of months. And you know the old saying, the longer the base, the higher in space. So, Juliet, it seems to me that there's a lot of reason to be bullish on the dollar. And, of course, with record short positioning in dollar index futures before this move began, it seems like a perfect setup for a massive short squeeze. But you told me off the air that you have been viewing this as a counter-trend rally and just an opportunity to short the dollar from a higher entry level when this move to the upside runs out of steam. So I know you have a plan to help our listeners see what I've been missing, which of course is the bearish case on the U.S. dollar. So why don't we start with your last report? Tell us why it was titled Toto, I Have a Feeling We're Not in Kansas Anymore. And from there, let's dive into your chart deck.
Well, when I was writing the report, it reminded me of this quote from The Wizard of Oz, when Judy Garland lands somewhere and knows it's no longer feeling comfortable, but can't quite describe it precisely yet. So basically a phase of transition. I see growing signs that we've transitioned from late mid-cycle to early late cycle, and it's happened because of Trump's tax reform, paradoxically. Effectively, Trump's taken the burden of proof away from the economy. The fact that a less than 1% fiscal impulse can be expected this year, and maybe a bit more than 1% next year, means that the belief that, quote-unquote, the U.S. economy is strong has become incredibly entrenched. And we'll see later that I don't really believe it's the case. Nonetheless, a shift has happened at the Fed, whereby skepticism about reflation has given way to inflation fear, and whether inflation actually materializes or not matters less than the fact that it is actually feared, which means that higher term premium. So the first chart that I would like to point out is the chart one that shows 10-year risk neutral yields have stalled. Just to remind your auditors, the risk-neutral yield is a mathematical bootstrap of Fed funds over the next 10 years, whereas the term premium should be thought about as a measure of fear around that central case scenario. So you can see at the top, the risk-neutral yield has basically stalled, and the last breakout, and I didn't catch a 2 days breakout, but basically the last breakout is mostly driven by term premium. Bottom line is that the Fed's reaction function has become asymmetrical, despite a recent insistence in the FOMC statements on symmetry. And what I mean by that is we could have A, equities go up, and yields have to converge to the dot plot with a potential premium for increased concerns about financial stability. And I'll come back on that later. And that increases nominal yields and strengthens the dollar, particularly versus the most vulnerable EM, which fund in dollar. And we have continued to see the effect of that on Argentina and Turkey. Or B, equities go down, but the Fed's line in the sand on equity weakness is now a long way down the beach, effectively because of Trump's put on the US economy. The result is that real yields are moving higher and the dollar is strengthening more broadly, including versus other reserve currencies like euro, yen, and gold. And the bottom line I would like to point out on the chart too, and what will really matter for the rest of this interview, is that we've entered a vicious circle where financial conditions will necessarily trend lower. And you can see that by the divergence between financial condition index in blue and SPX in green. Why it matters for the dollar is that, in my view, the dollar higher on higher real yields is not sustainable because it sharply tightens financial conditions.
Okay, that divergence is an excellent point. Are there other reasons to think that there's been a regime shift?
Yes, actually, I have a few more observations to make on that subject. And the charts I'll be talking about are key to determine how fast the late cycle period will last. I said that we've entered early late cycle, but there can be obviously time lag of like 12 to 18 months until we actually see a rollover. And given your concern is the dollar, I'll explain how it also determines the dollar outlook. One way to look at equity valuation consistently across business cycles is to use the equity risk premium. Essentially, it considers earning yields and adjusts for real bond yields. So the effect is that it removes the R-star from the valuation equation. And I think this is key in this cycle, given the collapse in neutral yield and its magnifying effect on future cash flow valuation. The equity risk premium basically allows for a more accurate analysis across cycles, and it's been the one metric that allowed us to stay long equities all the way through January. The point about the equity risk premium is that it is supposed to compress as monetary accommodation is removed, and the reason it should be compressing is that monetary accommodation should be removed in line with a more resilient macro outlook. Well, you can see on chart 3 that it is no longer the case. The correlation is normally strong and consistent across cycles and persistent even on short time frames. But you can see that since February, there's a meaningful divergence, which suggests that the expected level of Fed accommodation, which I chart here in green, and I basically use five-year real yields minus R star for that. And you can see that it's no longer in line with gross expectations as you would be expressing through SPX equity risk premium. And this is really interesting because it's a dynamic that we can observe at the end of the last two cycles. So if you take chart 4, you can see that in 2000, we had an inflation scare. And also the Fed was quite willing to burst the equity bubble then as well. And that basically caused the Fed to hike 50 basis points, even as markets, equity markets, were already sensing a growth slowdown. And the economy basically rolled over in less than 6 months after that. Similar thing happened in 2007, where the divergence between equity risk premium and accommodation also signaled the end of the cycle. So you can see in July 2007, basically the SPX equity risk premium started to collapse when accommodation was still towards the highs.
Okay, that's a really excellent point. But just to play devil's advocate, it seems to me, if we go back to chart 3, looking at the equity premium, one could argue that the equity risk premium is really just catching up to higher real yields. So is this temporary? Is this a game changer? What are we really seeing here?
I mean, that's completely true. The issue here is that equity's main driver in the recent like 2 weeks has been slightly disappointing inflation reads that sort of like reignited the Goldilocks environment. We also had, obviously, stellar earnings and prospects of upcoming buybacks. But the interesting thing, if you go back to that chart 3, is that triple B credit spreads did not get the memo at all. And they've actually continued to widen and highlight late cycle dynamics, which are temporarily hidden inequities, in my view.
Okay, but why is that?
That's a great question. And I think the easiest way to answer this is that credit is priced on EBITDA, which reflects the fundamental health of the business rather than EPS growth for equities. Well, the tax reform or any financing tricks don't affect EBITDA. So credit is at this point of the cycle, in my opinion, a better gauge of the state of the economy. And I've also attached a few other charts that will be key to pinpoint a more dangerous turn for the business cycle and which also signal greater credit concerns. And they all like coming from data that were released in the last 10 days. So firstly, there's been the NACM credit manager survey. You can see on chart 6 that we've had a substantial dip, which is actually something that would be expected after such a big move in five-year real yields. So in orange on chart 6, you can see the credit manager index are started to roll over. Secondly, and that's a survey that we got last week, the Fed Senior Loan Officer survey, shows also a turn in consumer credit standards. It's been stable for corporates, but there's been quite a tightening in standard on especially on credit card loans. So that's on chart 7, where you can also see that consumer demand for loans continued to trend lower. And the last chart I wanted to point out, obviously, you've all noticed that volatility has picked up this year on the back of deteriorating growth-inflation combo. The combo basically has been tilting more and more towards stagflation than Goldilocks. Goldilocks, just to remind everyone, is market condition that prevailed until last year with what I used to call a growth purgatory. So that's mediocre but stable growth and low inflation, keeping the Fed at bay. So all those charts, and I have a lot more, but I didn't want to spend too much time on that, is the charts that I want to keep on the radar to analyze the end of the cycle dynamic. And that will help us with trading all asset classes, but also obviously the dollar.
Okay, let's go back to the U.S. dollar view, because I think we're looking at cycle dynamics, the overall economic cycle. Let's tie that back in. How does it fit with your dollar view?
Eric, as I mentioned in my intro, this year's dollar is not as straightforward as last year for the simple reasons that the late cycle trading conditions become by design very tactical. Also, this is something I did touch base about in the last interview, but there isn't one dollar. There is the dollar versus other reserve currencies, and that includes the yen, the euro, gold, and Chinese yuan, and dollar versus commodities and emerging markets. And in fact, you could now argue that there's such large discrepancies between fundamentals of different emerging markets that it's becoming more and more difficult to look at emerging markets as a whole. So the reserve currencies tend to be driven more by real interest rate differential, which should reflect real growth potential differential. And I expect this cycle to end with an overshoot in real yields instead of an overshoot in equities. And that's the reason I decided to exit long euro, yen, and gold versus dollar at the end of April. The EM and commodity currencies are more driven by the absolute dollar yield level, as emerging markets are mostly funded in dollar, especially privately. This is their main weakness when the business cycle is out of sync with the US cycle, as financial conditions there tighten out of line with the inner strengths of the domestic economies. So in my framework, there's two main drivers. One specific to this cycle in the US, large-scale fiscal stimuli need to be financed. This basically leads to higher rates if the Fed counters the fiscal loosening with monetary tightening, or a much weaker dollar if the Fed chooses to overlook a temporary overheating. The growth profile also needs to be taken into account, as large fiscal stimuli can also be financed with higher growth and a strong Keynes multiplier. But we'll see later that this is unlikely to be the case. The second driver in my framework is real yield differential with the rest of the world. And the reason we appear to have decorrelated there in 2017 is that we were correcting a 2015-2016 overshoot. And you can see that very clearly on chart 9. So my point is that real interest rate differential do matter, but the first dollar down leg only corrected an overshoot. So in a benign global growth environment, like last year, higher US real yields were accompanied by brighter growth prospects. And the fact that the end of the Fed hiking cycle would be followed by a monetary normalization in the rest of the world, and what we call in macro jargon monetary convergence, allowed the dollar to stay weak even as rates were going up. And it gave the illusion that the US dollar was diverging from an historically reliable driver, real yield differential, with the rest of the world. But I don't think it was the case.
Well, I can tell you for certain that I've been very confused by that apparent disconnect between real yield and the rest of the world. So it certainly is succeeding at confusing me, if nothing else. This, I think a lot of our listeners have been confused by this. So can you go through in detail what happened this year?
So there's been two game changers this year in Q2. Firstly, increased inflation fear. So there's been in April a surge in commodity prices, obviously oil as well, due to trade tensions and geopolitical worries. And that was literally inflation that I would call exogenous, because it came out of outside concerns rather than increased global demand. And so that added to concerns that the US, which is the most advanced economy in the global cycle, may be judged by the Fed as closer to overheating. We actually need to add to that concern from the Fed a new sort of like third mandate relating to financial stability. Literally, the Fed told us that they don't want financial conditions to loosen more. So those two new drivers are focused on the United States, where equity valuation is most concerning and where inflation is now on target. There's just one thing I would like to caveat here is that if you compare US inflation with European inflation like for like, which you would need to take out basically shelter out of US inflation, out of CPIX, the difference between European and US inflation is only like 0.4%. And it's literally almost perfectly explained by the relative currency performance over the past 2 years. So if the dollar does well, like Europe gets more inflation, and then the reverse is true as well. So that's obviously a big caveat. But the point is, like, the Fed thinks that they're on target. The second game changer is that US real yields continue to rally, but in a less supportive growth environment. And this is something that I've already highlighted in your second question, via the divergence between real yields and the equity risk premiums, and also credit spreads, and by the breakdown in the correlation, basically. So now you will ask, what's the issue with real yields? Why does it matter whether it rallies and when stocks go up, or whether it rallies in a supportive growth environment? It is really crucial, because in a supportive growth environment, the end game, and let's say the end game here is when the Fed is done hiking, is monetary policy normalization for the rest of the world if we are in a supportive growth environment. Whereas if we are in unsupportive growth environment, the end game is basically recession, which cancels any chance of monetary convergence. So if we have real yields going up, growth going up, then we just can be focused on the fact that ECB and BOJ are going to be the next ones to hike rates. But if the end game is recession, then there's nothing to look forward to for the BOJ and the ECB. And I think that's been really what's been driving markets for the last 4 weeks. And it's probably been the greatest challenge to the dollar bearish narrative this year, especially given, as you pointed out, increased positioning.
Juliet, that begs a question in my mind, which is, you've told us already that you covered your short positions to get out of the way of a counter-trend rally. So you must be looking to get back into a dollar short by going long. Well, I guess that's part of the question. Is it still going to be euro, gold, and yen that you go long against the dollar? And when do you do that? Is there a level you're looking at? Is there some event you're waiting for? What tells you it's time to short the dollar? And which assets do you use? Which pairs do you use against the dollar when that time comes?
It's difficult to give you such a straightforward question, so I'll cover it in the next few questions. I think there are many cross currents this year, and the straight answer is that you will have to be nimble in 2018. Let me try and explain what I'm looking at and the framework I use at JDI Research to gauge the most likely direction and find attractive risk-reward trades, even in a choppy environment. The first thing to bear in mind is that monetary convergence is not in any way cancelled. It's just put on ice until a firm top in US real yields is in place. And arguably, given the very high hurdle to a Fed relent, I estimate that real yields may climb a further 25 basis points until we see more visible signs of macro stress emerge. The problem the Fed has at the moment is that it's sort of targeting like two different neutral rates for the two-speed U.S. economy. So a higher one is needed to keep financial conditions in check in Wall Street, but a lower one is probably needed to balance the real economy, e.g. final demand. So, and at the moment, the Fed looks like it's now converging to the higher one. And this will, in my mind, soon be visible through lower real final demand in the US. At that point, the Fed will be forced to pull its foot off the brake and US real yield versus rest of the world will converge again, but negatively converge, meaning like US real yields lower. Let us not forget that the Fed is the only DM central bank with any easing ammunition. And once the global slowdown becomes more severe and when the US credit risk rises meaningfully, I think we can expect German and Japanese savings, which are currently parked in the US, where, by the way, there is a lack of aggregate saving, to be repatriated very quickly. And that will be the second leg of my longstanding dollar short recommendation, and one that I will ensure I catch using a framework that I've developed over the last 20 years. So to summarize, stable global growth, and we see a weaker dollar broadly, plunging global growth, and we see a weaker dollar versus reserve currencies. So gold, euro, yen, and probably China as well. The issue here is that we're in transition phase. And if you take the chart 10, which was actually last updated on Monday with OECD leading indicators, you will see that using the diffusion index as a leading indicator for global growth. So the leading indicator is the diffusion index in blue. And you can see that it's leading the actual headline by 6 to 12 months. So I can say with a degree of confidence that 2019 will not be a supportive growth environment. But unfortunately, like 2018 is a kind of in between where you sort of know where you're going, but you don't know at what speed, and hence the choppiness. This will most likely mean a top in global tightening and a negative monetary convergence at some point towards either in the second end of this year or next year, and a dollar sell-off in dollar yen towards 98 in my view and 145 in euro.
Juliet, let's focus on the short-term time horizon. Based on this whole framework that you've just described, does that lead you to some specific recommendations in the immediate time frame?
On the short-term horizon, we certainly granted some respite on the inflation side. So what did we have? You can see on the chart 11, we had lower than expected earnings. So I think and you can see the 3 months running analyze has actually really come off quite sharply. Same thing is true for CPI, where we are on target because of very strong positive base effect. But if you're actually looking at the last number, it was really weak. And we also strongly came down on a 3 months running core CPI analyzed. So we're now like just above 1% at 1.2%, when I think 3 months ago we were running like above 3% on a 3 month basis. And the same thing has been true for import prices as well, which are not really shooting up, despite the fact that the weaker dollar over the past 2 years should now really been feeding through. Also, I've been warning about a global slowdown since January. I also now believe that it's sort of like temporarily priced in, and especially in one asset class that's seen very strong outflow this year, especially amongst hedge funds, and that's emerging markets. And I think we could be like soon entering the eye of the storm as far as emerging markets are concerned. And the quid pro quo for resetting inflation scare probabilities is that there is also less chance of Fed mistake. So that's the reason why I think we could be entering the eye of the storm, simply because there'll be no forced acceleration in the tightening cycle and a more supportive risk environment with growth in China potentially bottoming. So that reignites hope that monetary convergence can eventually happen, and also real yield will inevitably stay supported in the US. The more supported risk environment means that the dollar should stall against better quality emerging markets. So I've recommended short dollars are with a stop at the May highs, and also long Aussie versus short yen to reflect on one side a more stable growth outlook than what markets are pricing in. I think we've been a little bit too fast to start looking for global growth collapse. And on the other side, higher real yields in the US will mean that the dollar yen stays supported. So long Aussie versus yen.
Okay, Juliet. So you're saying go long the South African rand, ZAR, against the dollar, and also long the Australian dollar against the Japanese yen. Why is that?
So there's a few reasons. And the first one you will see on chart number 12, that China CPI was actually quite soft recently. And that means that there is scope for a monetary boost, and that should trade tensions persist and cut into growth. And in fact, it's already started to happen, and we have seen triple R being cut and various fiscal easing. Secondly, you can see the blue line on chart number 12, that the credit impulse in China is actually quite far from falling off a cliff. I think there are some fears that after the last Congress, the Chinese authority would be reining in credit much more aggressively. And it's not been the case at all. And the last credit numbers we received were from last week. So it's been trending lower, but no collapse. And literally the lower inflation pulse suggests that a continued baby step-like deleveraging is possible. In fact, to come back to Monday's OECD leading indicators, you will actually see on chart 13 in orange that OECD leading indicator for China is showing tentative signs of a bottom in growth momentum. And obviously, the Chinese cycle is leading the Australian cycle. Hence my recommendation for a tactical long Aussie, where idiosyncratic risk of housing bust has started to get priced in together with slower Chinese imports. So I think there is a window of opportunity for Aussie yen to get some relief here and move like 2-3% higher. So first, Chinese monetary and fiscal authorities are given increased room to ease as inflation appears under control. And second, there is tentative signs of stabilization in activity momentum. And thirdly, and that's a very important point that I want to make, is that a lot of investors look at emerging markets as an asset class, and it's been the case for the last 20 years, with most emerging markets being commodity exporters dancing to the tune of China. But I've created an index of OECD leading indicators for Brazil, India, Russia, and South Africa, which would basically be emerging markets ex-Asia. And you can see on chart 14 here that growth momentum in these countries, Brazil, India, Russia, and South Africa, have completely decoupled from China. So the whole sort of like China is going to be having a growth slowdown and it will affect emerging markets is not really true anymore. You can see on the chart 14 that the Chinese cycle used to lead all emerging markets, but for the last 2 years, that correlation has completely broken down. So Russia may be held off by US sanctions. India may be held off by oil prices. And probably Brazil will be held off by local politics. But South Africa is very interesting. It's still gaining momentum in terms of growth, and its current account deficit has dramatically improved since 2014 by about like 4%. So in short, EM ex-Asia has to endure higher US yields, obviously, but aggregate financing needs have largely decreased, and the EM ex-Asia growth backdrop has stayed very solid. And this means that higher US yields are not totally out of whack with the EM growth environment and literally their capacity to repay. So one thing to bear in mind here is there are very large disparities of macro fundamentals today in EM, and that some EM might be worth looking at the moment after this large sell-off. That's where I would like to start to re-enter short dollar. If you look on chart 15, just to add up on that particular point, you can see that the taper tantrum, so starting from like 2012, going into 2013, was one of the backdrop in the taper tantrum was one of a very strong US growth versus the rest of EM and rising real yield differentials. So there's two things that we need to look at for emerging markets is where is the growth potential versus the rest of the versus US, and where are real yields versus US? Because if you have like way too high yields compared to your growth potential, that's obviously when financial conditions tighten way too much in the country. And that's how you end up with the large sell-off that we've seen in the taper tantrum. But in my mind, the difference this time is that the big four growth backdrop is actually quite solid, especially given my opinion that the strong US backdrop is only temporary. So I wouldn't completely disagree with, I think it was Powell saying that emerging markets should be able to deal with higher US rates. It's obviously not true for all of them. For Argentina, it's going to be tough. And, you know, basically Turkey is a basket case. It's also going to be a nightmare. But some EM are actually going to be quite resilient.
Okay, Juliet, I think your U.S. dollar outlook is much clearer to me now. I have a question, though. Would surprising strength in the U.S. economy be a threat to your outlook?
So let's go to the chart number 16 for that, which is I've titled The U.S. Consumer Remains Jubilant, as you can see from the Conference Board Consumer Confidence, which is shooting new highs. But it doesn't have much dollars in its pocket, as you can see from the blue line, which is showing real aggregate income growth year on year. And from that chart, you can see that, you know, as happy as you can be about and as confident as you can be about the economy, the fact is you can only spend what's being put in your pocket. And that's really what I wanted to say, because one thing to remember about the US is that 70% of the economy is driven by consumption. And the consumer is already leveraged. And that means that growth will not deviate meaningfully from real income gains. There's no labor slack anymore, which means that the economy can only accelerate on higher wages, which in turn will squeeze profit margins and mean and higher yields. There is no real path in my mind to sustainable growth in the US due to late cycle dynamics, and no sustainable path, therefore, to growth divergence with EM either. And that makes me confident that a EM rally is tradable, where the growth backdrop is still relatively solid and where fundamental imbalance have receded, e.g. South Africa as my short-term picks. The last chart that I would like to show you is the number 17, and in gray is the credit impulse. So it's sort of like showing you when growth is basically boosted by credit. And there's been a huge boost in credit since the Q3 2017. And this has not stopped yet. So I cannot say for sure that the US growth momentum has peaked before that peaks as well. But this chart will really help me time the next downturn, because once the credit impulse peaks, the loss of growth momentum in the US will become more frightening.
Well, Juliet, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Finally, your view on the dollar is clear to me. It hasn't been until now, and it helps me quite a bit. I know our listeners have appreciated it. I want to talk for a minute about your institutional advisory service. You know, historically, you have been an institutional advisor. Your services are beyond the reach of at least the average retail investor. But we've actually been surprised. Quite a few private investors, high net worth individuals and family offices and so forth, have signed up for your service as a result of learning about you on Macro Voices. And we're delighted to help you find that business. And I particularly appreciate that you've been good enough to cater the pricing to the type of investor that you're dealing with. So please give us a sense of what's on offer from your service, where people can find out more about it. And I know Patrick Serezna, our producer, has become a very aggressive negotiator for Macro Voices discounts. Are you offering anything for our listeners in conjunction with this interview?
Firstly, I wanted to really thank you for inviting me once again, because your show is a treat for everyone every week and your content is invaluable. I also have met a lot of your subscribers over the past year, and I wanted to thank you all via Twitter, emails. You all always have astute questions and comments that challenge my beliefs and on which I can bounce with new ideas. So really, thanks for taking the time to read, listen, and ponder upon what I have to say. And thanks, Eric, for introducing me to them. That's something I literally only do for Macro Voices listeners, and I will do it this time, is to offer a very substantial discount for any subscription, any one-year subscription, agreed by the end of this month. And to benefit from this offer, you can just email me directly, juliette.declercq at jdiresearch.com. Or you can just reach me through my website, jdiresearch.com, which is also going to be on at the bottom. All my details are going to be at the bottom of the chart pack as well. So if you're interested, just get in touch. You know, in any case, I'll be happy to reply any questions anyone may have. Anything that is not completely clear after this long presentation, email me, tweet me, I'll be there. Yeah, my Twitter handle is at Juliet, J-U-L-I-E-T-T-E, not the American way, J-D-I. So Juliet, J-D-I, J-D-I for Juliet Declercq Independent.
Well, Juliet, I can't thank you enough, and something I'd like to recommend to our listeners, spend the time to really mull over Juliet's charts. There is way more content and value in this chart book than we even had time to dive into. It's just, I'm so impressed with your charts, Juliet. It's really fantastic. In any case, in the interest of time, we need to leave it there. Patrick Serezna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests at macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag at macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Eric, what a great interview with Juliet. Now, before we get to our post game, we do have a little housekeeping to talk about. What is going on?
Our fantastic webmaster, Mike, is on vacation in Europe. And what that means to you, listeners, is we do have a research roundup email for you that has Juliet's chart pack in it. But for the other articles, the stuff that Patrick and I didn't find links to until after Mike's plane departed, you're going to have to log into the website. Everything is still there. So if you log in at macrovoices.com using the same username and password that you registered with when you first signed up to get Research Roundup, just go, once you're logged in, to the Research Library tab on the black menu bar at the top of the page, then go under Guest Publications, and you'll be able to find everything, including Tony Greer's chart book, because he sent us a great book of graphs and charts that we're going to discuss next. Unfortunately, we can't get the links into the Research Roundup email because the guy that does that is on vacation. So thank you for your patience and understanding. Again, log in at macrovoices.com, Research Library on the black menu bar, and then look under Guest Publications, and you'll find Tony Greer's chart book there. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Tony Greer from TG Macro. Tony, I'm particularly interested to get your take on Juliet de Klerk's interview. You know, I personally, like yourself, I've been kind of bullish on the U.S. dollar. It seems to me like rate differentials are only going to improve from here. We had the big breakout this week, 3.05, didn't last long. On the 10-year Treasury, we're already up to 3.11 as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon. Seems to me like there's a lot of reasons to be dollar bullish, but boy, I've learned the hard way not to fade Juliet de Klerk's views, because first time we had her on the program, frankly, she was bearish and I thought she was crazy, and the market went straight down from there. She made a lot of good calls after that. So what was your reaction to the arguments that Juliet made? Did it change your bullish outlook on the U.S. dollar at all?
Well, actually, Eric, she shined a lot of light on some topics that I'm not up to speed on, like how far consumer confidence is outpacing our real consumption. But it doesn't change my view on the dollar. She's looking at it from a different perspective, as in this rally is a counter trend rally. And I'm looking at it from the perspective that this is the resumption of the dollar rally sort of off of the lows from 2011, 2012.
And Patrick, what were your reactions?
For me, it was the final chart, number 16, where she showed the divergence between consumer confidence versus that of the personal consumption and the aggregate income growth. You know, for me, it really asked the question, how strong is that U.S. growth cycle? And that's what I really want to get to with you here, Tony. So, Tony, first of all, welcome to the show. I wanted to move to your chart book, where the first page of the chart book, you started to put two charts on the dollar index and build your dollar argument. And you have one that is like a daily chart looking back a few years, and then you have a multi-decade chart going all the way back to like 99, 2000. Tell us what you're trying to show us on this chart.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, I look at the dollar index as having been, you know, consolidating, but in an uptrend off the 2011 lows. Okay, we ran into the Trump election in 2016, which I think changed everything. And that had a specific effect on the dollar for me. Steve Mnuchin and President Trump very early in the administration came out and said that they thought a weaker dollar would be better for the U.S. economy. They started jawboning it lower. So to me, the whole entire move and the consolidation in 2018, that whole thing, the administration jawboning the dollar down, I think that what it's doing now is obviously resuming trend. And I think that's because, you know, the dollar differential finally got to a point where the FX market couldn't tolerate a weaker dollar as the U.S., as U.S. yields are breaking higher and meaningfully so. So I'm looking at this dollar move as, you know, a resumption of the uptrend off of those 2011 lows.
Now, what I find interesting, obviously, you make it the case that if the U.S. dollar is going to be bullish, then that's certainly not good for those non-yielding assets. Obviously, on page two, you were talking about the U.S. dollar yen, as well as you wanted to comment on gold. What's your thinking here on these non-yielding assets?
Well, you know, I kind of compare yen and gold. I throw them in the same boat on that chart page, right? Dollar yen is an easy chart for me to be bullish, both fundamentally mentally and technically. Okay, so when I look at that chart, I feel like dollar yen is consolidated and is about to attack resistance on the upside alongside, you know, this dollar disparity and the rate disparity here. the biggest thing for me is that gold is sort of, you know, now again, behaving like a non-yielding asset at like the yen. And sort of the market is telling us right now that there's no need for those types of assets. What's been very interesting is that, you know, the rally in crude oil as seems to have changed the dynamic in the commodity markets. It is leading me toward a very inflationary theme via raw materials prices. I'm taking my cues from things like crude oil and lumber and aluminum that are trading sort of with fits and starts to the upside. And I think I'm letting those show me the way as to where the inflation is going to come from. I'm expecting inflation in raw materials, seeing inflation in transport costs, and all of these are creating more interesting trades for the community than being long gold, which, as we've said, is not a yielding asset. So people are getting rid of gold off their portfolios. I think at some point you have to have cryptocurrency enter that conversation, although I don't know how much you want to go into that. But I think that that's going to be an interesting investment alternative for decades to come as I read, you know, the headlines there. And, you know, I have to say this dollar move technically for me is a resumption of trend. And I really want to go with all the bells and whistles that go along with a strong dollar and strong natural resources moves.
Tony, I'm particularly interested to get your perspective on crude oil, a subject that's very much dear to my own heart. Seems to me like, you know, is very clearly an unrelenting uptrend here. I think it's really been fueled a lot by geopolitical tension. At the same time, you know, even before the geopolitics picked up, it was getting big. Now, I think that there's probably has to be at least a pullback at some point because we have ignored some bearish fundamentals. But I'm starting to feel more and more like the trend is likely to continue up after that pullback. And I think that's probably similar to what I see here. Give us your perspective and outlook for crude oil going forward.
Sure, Eric. I remain an unrepentant oil bull at the moment. My bullish thesis started off originally, literally near the bottom in 2016, moving into the late part of the year, you know, knowing that the Saudi Aramco IPO was going to hit the tape and seeing Saudi Arabia start to posture for that. As we got into 2017, we talked about OPEC compliance, OPEC production cuts and their amazing adherence to those production cuts. That to me was sort of the main signal that the Saudis were very serious about draining the excess supplies that we've had. As a result, the inventories have drained, spreads have tightened up tremendously. We've gone from contango to very steep backwardation in the crude oil curve, and that's only attracted more investment. When I look at the whole entire crude oil move, I look at it in terms of a reverse head and shoulders with the absolute low in 2016 at around $25 and the neckline at around $57. Since crude oil has gotten above there, I just look at it as a sort of head and shoulders retracement move up to 84, and everything in between there is kind of, you know, just the natural dynamic of, you know, trading to the highs and pulling back into the moving average support, et cetera, et cetera. But when I look at the underlying fundamentals, I remain really bullish crude oil. A lot of it has to do with the export story. Okay, as we lifted the export ban back in December 2015, we started exporting crude all around the world. Now we are setting records, you know, weekly with our export to Asia and Latin America in crude oil and to China of gasoline. And this really continues to set up as a bullish picture for me. You know, the Saudis have been really, really firm in keeping production cut story and narrative alive. I'm sure you saw in the headlines just last week, they mentioned 80 and then the potential of $100 crude oil. And as long as they're not taking their eye off of that target, I'm not taking my eye off the ball. So that's how I'm looking at the crude oil market right now. We're in the middle innings of a rally to 85.
Tony, I think that you make an excellent point, and boy, this rally has been relentless and the bid has been amazing. But let me play devil's advocate. We have overlooked a lot of bearish news because there's been so much geopolitical excitement in the market. And at the same time, we've built up this just incredible record, all-time record, speculative long interest in crude oil futures to the point where everybody's on one side of the boat. Now, that has come off a little bit in the last couple of weeks, but we're still in record territory. And that suggests to me that if we do get some bearish data that starts to push prices back down a bit, it could start an avalanche effect where that huge speculative long starts to unwind. Everybody's bailing out at once. And, you know, before you know it, you could be $20 to the downside if you really had a disorderly abandonment of that entire speculative long. What's your reaction to those kind of risks?
Well, Eric, you know, like you, I'm a commodity trader, and I definitely keep one eye on the commitment of traders reports. I try not to get into the trading camp of allowing a large speculative position to be the reason for me to get bearish. Okay. I rather look at it as, okay, why are all these people piling into the market? I think that that speaks to a few blind spots that the oil traders tend to have. They look at a rallying price, they see length expanding in spec positions, and they say, oh, well, there must be a mean reversion in here somewhere. Well, I don't like to play mean reversions, and I don't like to put targets on spec positions in commodities that are combusted at such a high rate like crude oil every day. Okay, so I think part of the other side of the long spec position that people aren't seeing is a chart that I put on the bottom of page 4, which is the swap dealer position. Okay, that is the equivalent of oil producers selling a tremendous amount of oil forward, more than they have ever in our history. And that speaks to the swap dealers sort of making the producers sell forward so to know that they can get paid back on loans. But this is a little bit like when the gold producers, gold miners hedged all their forward production back in 1999, 2000. And then when gold traded up through their strikes, there was a really, really intense accelerative rally through 350, 400, all the way to prices that we're at now. So when I see producers selling as much oil as they are forward and supplies continuing to drain, that's how I know that there's a sort of balanced side to that spec position. And that's the oil that's being combusted and sold forward into the markets. This situation that we're in right now is really positive for the refiners. We are exporting an enormous amount of gasoline to China because their refiners can't even keep up with the demand. And I think that that's sort of the blind spot that the market's not seeing in taking the gasoline and oil away from the markets, keeping the spec length in good shape.
Now, just to keep the devil's advocate going, there's another big argument that people make, which is, hey, these, you know, this is a solution to high prices is high prices. At these prices, you're seeing now record rig count in the Bakken. You're seeing, we've had last week an 85,000 barrel increase in production. This week, it was only 20,000. But, you know, we're saying only 20,000. That annualizes to 1 million barrels a year. So we're going to see somewhere between 1 million and 4 million barrels of additional U.S. production over the course of the next year. That's a lot. And admittedly, you know, we've got Venezuela falling apart. Things are coming offline in other places. But that's a lot. Does that at some point at least lead to a significant pullback in prices here? Or do you think this rally can just continue to march higher?
Well, you know, there's always the dynamic of a back and forth. And I think that the steepness of the rally can flatten out. But if that puts crude oil back into moving average support, I think that it's going to be met with plenty of buying around there. You know, the dynamic that's going on now is that the Cushing is just a way station, right? All of this oil is basically getting stranded here in the mid-continent. You know, that's why the Brent WTI spread continues to widen with Brent over WTI. Okay, that's reacting a little bit to the U.S. pulling out of the Iran deal and the oil that will have to be replaced due to that. But I think that as long as this dynamic remains firm, where we're seeing the demand taking supply out of the system and inventories continuing to drain, you know, I'm going to be on the lookout for pullbacks. But, you know, I still think that there are more people waiting to get into the crude oil market than there are trying to get out. That's how I'm looking at it.
Well, that's a really interesting view there, Tony. And, you know, I want to move on, though, to on page 5 of your chart book, you really wanted to speak to this emerging market story. Obviously, we heard Juliet kind of build her arguments on emerging markets. But you're thinking here on a very traditional basis that the emerging markets are vulnerable here. What's your thinking?
Yeah. And I, you know, I feel like the thinking is laid out clearly on that page 6 in the charts. You know, when you look at how JP Morgan's emerging market currency index fared in from 2013 to 2015, and what, for example, ETF EEM, the emerging markets ETF did. So from that period of time, while the emerging market currencies were getting slaughtered in a strong dollar environment from 2013 to 2015, EEM was sideways to lower. It actually pulled back from 45 to 30. Now, the only time the emerging markets were able to get back on their feet is when we had this post election dollar bashing going on that nobody could really understand because it was going counter to the interest rate differential we were seeing. Now, there's really no denying that, you know, U.S. yields are marching higher. Today's a major breakout, in my opinion, above 305. So when you've got the world moving into the set of assets where they can purchase U.S. treasuries and earn a yield and they want to be in the dollar, I feel like, you know, given the technical setup in EEM, where we've had a big blow off top up to 52, and then we put in a double top at 50, and now we see JP Morgan's emerging market currency index curling over, and all of a sudden you find the emerging markets ETF at its 200-day moving average support. And I think people have already gotten well into the emerging market length. I would be very shocked if we didn't see a pullback in emerging markets to about $40 level in EEM, coincidental with strong U.S. yields and a stronger dollar.
All right. Well, I have to kind of then guide you to the next level, because, I mean, you're building a pretty interesting story. Obviously, you have your views on crude oil and dollar. How does this all come together for the U.S. stock market with something like the S&P 500? Do you, like Eric and I have shared many times, that we think that the bull market is run its course and that we're going through some sort of an extended topping formation. Does this storyline that you have build that same narrative? What's your thinking on the markets?
Yeah, it absolutely does, Patrick. I look at it as the paint is drying when I look at the S&P chart, and to sort of put that into a little bit more clear context, we painted a high up to 2,900 in the S&P back in January. I honestly think that that's the high of the year, and that was the end of the bull market that started in 2009. After that move, we put in another double top at 2,800, so a similar chart pattern to the emerging markets ETF. And from here, I think that we moved into a higher volatility regime in the wake of the short volatility strategy XIV blowing up. I believe that there are sort of other short volatility strategies out there, along with risk parity, that are coming under pressure with these unprecedented moves, as in the dollar going higher alongside crude oil going higher, and or the S&P going down while the bond market is going down. So I think that's adding a little bit of stress to these comfortable positions that have been in the markets for 10 years. And I think that we're going to be in a mega consolidative phase, where I want to go from buying momentum like we've been doing for the last 10 years to sort of selling momentum and really, really being careful what I buy on dips. At this point in the market, in the bull run, I'm trying to convert my holdings from sort of more passive, go along with the markets, go along with the sectors, ETFs, into much more specific equity plays. I'm moving into things like refiners and wheat stocks because I think that they've got a lot more potential than the broader market here. So yeah, I'm expecting consolidation to lower for the remainder of this year.
Tony, we're going to have to leave it there in the interest of time. But before we wrap things up, please tell our listeners where they can follow your work and find out more about what you do at TG Macro.
Yeah, sure, Eric. I keep it simple. You can find me on Twitter at tgmacro.com. You can find me on my website at www.tgmacro.com. There are some video presentations at the bottom, and you can subscribe to a sprint trial of my newsletter on the homepage.
Okay, Tony, thanks so much. And again, listeners, that's at tgmacro.com on Twitter, or just www.tgmacro.com on the internet. We're going to have to leave it there in the interest of time. But before we do, we need your help promoting Macro Voices. Please tell your friends and colleagues about Macro Voices, forward your research roundup emails, and most importantly, register your free account at macrovoices.com. It's free. It only takes a minute. We're not going to spam you or try to sell you anything. The benefit to you is you'll receive our free research roundup email, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It normally contains links to all the coolest stuff we could find on the internet each week. As I mentioned earlier, this week and next week only, you're going to have to log into the website and go to the research library section of our website in order to find all of that great content. But it is there if you go and log in and look for it. We'll have our normal research roundup email format back working in 2 weeks from today. Patrick, tell them what they'll find in the research library when they log in to macrovoices.com this week.
All right. Well, first of all, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview. You'll also find the link to the chart books for both Juliet and Tony's interview. You're going to find a number of interesting articles, including one from Doug Cass on Beware of Chasing Momentum. There's also a really interesting blog by Kevin Muir titled Pink Tickets on Quantitative Tightening Days. You'll find that and so much more at our research library at macrovoices.com. And we appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners. And we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. And you could also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.